One or two reviewers have said that it was ridiculous of me to suppose that I should treat the whole question of world Freemasonry in one book of under 100,000 words. It's even more ridiculous, of course, to assume that I can deal with it in a talk of 3/4 of an hour. But I will do my best. The Freemasons, the Masons, in fact, have always, right through the Middle Ages, were always regarded as something rather special. Whereas other crafts and trades dealt with individual customers. They sold their produce or made wooden houses or sold fish, whatever it was, to individuals. There were very few individuals who were wealthy enough to afford to pay for anything to be done in stone. And in fact, the only customers that the Masons had was a king, a few noblemen for whom they built castles, noblemen or other people who had been given what was called the king's license to castellate, which was to build a castle. You weren't allowed to build a fortified castle without the king's permission, and the church, and particularly the church, because cathedrals and abbeys and parish churches too were built in stone. And they occasionally also built bridges, including London Bridge, which was built, they started building it in 1176, finished building it in 1213, and indeed there was a very well-known popular song, "London Bridge is falling down, down over my lady leaning, London Bridge is falling down, how shall we build it up again with a fair lady?" And it goes on, "Don't build it in armour steel, with bend and bar. Don't build it in wood, which will just collapse and wash away, and build it in stone." And then for the last page is long, and in fact it did last for more than 600 years. And when it was finally pulled down in 1832, this was not because it was collapsing, but because the arches were too close together to allow the larger ships of the 19th century to pass underneath. Now in that song it says, "Dance over my lady Lee, and with a fair lady," and that's to the chorus. Well, who wants the fair lady? Everybody knew who she was, because the story went that when the Masons were building the bridge, they had walled up a young virgin alive in one of the stone pillars of the bridge as a sacrifice, as an offer to God, in the hope that this would appease his wrath and wouldn't allow the bridge to burn and die. This was widely believed. And it is, I think, the first of many lies about Masons which people have believed and circulated. That's from 1176 to the year 2000. The Masons put a lot of work because they were engaged particularly in the building of cathedrals, and they travelled all over the country to build the cathedrals. And building cathedrals required a large labour force. Most of them unskilled. Very largely, it consisted still of serfs who had run away from the land of their feudal lord to work on the cathedral, because there was a law that if you ran away from your feudal lord and could stay at liberty for a year and a day, you became free. And that's what most of the unskilled labor was. There were also a few very class noblemen used to go and work as an active part to help carry away the rubble and digging up the stone to be worked on. But the Masons, they were the expert workers. The idea which some people had that the Masons roamed all over the country looking for work and potential unemployed travelers, and that they had special words. I'll say something later about their word of identification, because otherwise they wouldn't have been recognized by the other Masons. That is completely untrue. Everybody knew who the Masons were, and they were much sought after by the bishops and abbots and deans for whom they lived in the building. There were in fact two kinds of Masons. The rough few-stone Masons who built the ordinary stone, and the three-stone Masons who worked in the soft three-stone, which was a softer stone, and did the decorative work on the cathedral faces. And this was very highly skilled work. They were the elite of the building profession. And because they worked in this top freestone, they were known as freestone masons. This was shortened to Freemasons, origin of the Hebrew, the word Hebrew, the Masons. One of the problems of the bishops and the abbots who had them working there was to keep them there, because they were very likely, if they skilled Eastern nations were working on cathedral places in Moscow or Salisbury, it was very likely to have an offer, perhaps not far away, somewhere in central Germany, to go and work there. So the abbots would try and bind them by contracts not to leave, they would finish their work. But normally, the Masons refused to sign any such contract. Of course, none of this applied when the king, or some great dignitary like Tom and Wolfgang, wanted them to work for him. There was no question of men of them going away. They were conscripted with an order to come, with an order to come from all over England, and from Worcestershire, from Yorkshire, everywhere, to help build the king's palace of none such a niche. And very often, as the king couldn't be absolutely certain that they would come and tell them to, he would simply arrest them and round them up and bring them forcibly to work. And of course, all the regulations about hours of work and so on, that went by the board when they were working for the king. Very often, they had to work all through the night. Between 1348 and 1350, the disease known as the Black Death spread through Europe. And in some places, it actually killed between one third and half of the population. The result, of course, was that there was a labor shortage. And that meant that wages rose because of the law of supply and demand, particularly in the case of skilled workers like the Eastern Masons. So Parliament stepped in, Parliament consisting, of course, of peers in the House of Lords and of gentlemen elected on a very narrow property franchise, who in fact, at an election, was a very unlikely to be normal, about 100 electors in a constituency with the right to vote, and they would all meet together in some room and elect their own king. So it was very much, of course, a class-dominated parliament. They passed wages, they passed laws, fixing not a minimum wage, but a maximum wage. There was no restriction on how low the wages could be, but these laws did make it a criminal offence, punishable by very heavy fines for the employer to offer or the workman to accept more than the maximum, which was sixpence a day in the case of the Masons. Of course, the value of money was completely different then. But these laws were evaded. Workmen, particularly skilled workmen, like the Free Masons, were in such a good bargaining position that they made illegal agreements with the employers to pay more than the maximum wage. Of course, these again tried to get in secret. The law was very largely evaded. In 1435, an attempt was made to tighten it by a new act of Parliament to increase the penalties, but even so, these were evaded. And this is the origin, of course, of the secrecy of the Freemasons. They were, in fact, an illegal trade union. When they met in their lodgings, the largest is, incidentally, the name of the place near the cathedral where the Masons used to go, where they kept their food, and used to go for their meals. They didn't sleep there. They would sleep probably in an inn in the local pub, but they'd keep their food there. And they would also meet there for these very secret illegal meetings, which they would try and get more wages than they were allowed to get by law. There was one place where things did not go quite so well for the Freemasons, and that was in Scotland, because there is no soft priesthood in Scotland. And this meant that the Masons there couldn't really exercise their skilled profession. Also, a system was introduced in Scotland, and this was devised in the 16th century, known as the Entered Apprentice System. In all other countries, no apprentice could become a master mason until he'd worked for a certain number of years. I think it was usually about 5 years, or master mason. And only a master mason could carry out skilled work as a mason. In Scotland, they had the Entered Apprentice System, by which it was after a much shorter apprentice, you could become an entered apprentice. And an entered apprentice was allowed to carry out nearly all the work at a master mason called. And the master masons didn't like that. So they decided to try and compass as far as possible by inventing a secret code word which would be known to all of the master masons, but would not be known to anyone else in particular. It would not be known to the entered apprentices, by which they could identify themselves. And this would probably develop into a little uncertain, but the way that it was suggested, this developed in Scotland in about 1550. And the word was probably Merlin, which is the word used in Scotland, actually right up until the 19th century, which is connected with the word mate or comrade. And this became known as the mason word. It was only used in Scotland and in a few counties in the north of England. It did just spread over the border. It never spread south of Durham, nor was it known anywhere else in Europe. There was no secrecy at all in other countries who were master mason was. And they had their other secrets. The fact that they were making these illegal contracts to get more than maximum wage, of course, was a secret. There was no question who the entity was. But this phrase, the mason word, became a phrase of enormous importance. And later on, when the masons did resort to certain secret means of identification, a great deal of time was attached. Now, a development occurred between about 1550 and 1700, which nobody really knows how to explain, but the Freemasons changed from being an organization of workers, operative masons, as they were called, to an organization of what was called at the time gentleman masons or accepted masons. And by the middle of the 18th century, they were called speculative masons. Instead of being working operative masons, it became a society of gentlemen. It might include some people below the rank of gentlemen, but mostly gentlemen, including a few noblemen who were interested in philosophy and believed in religious toleration. Believed in religious toleration, and that form of religion, which is known as deism, by which you believe in a god, but you don't believe anything more than that. You don't believe in any particular religious dogma. You just believe in a god who, or as the Masons after 1719 called him, the great architect of the universe. And this god might be a Protestant god, it might be a Catholic god, it might be a Jewish god. And then very soon, rule of this madness, it might be Allah, the Muslim god, or a Hindu god. It didn't matter what god it was, you must believe in a god, a great architect of the universe. And you know, nobody quite knows how this change took place. It was a rather remarkable change that an organization of building up the nations to become a speculative society of people who believed in religious toleration. In a loose kind of theism, but there are one or two truths to the claim. From the very earliest times, it had been the practice of the city livery company in London and the trade guilds in other cities, including in Scotland, to admit gentlemen and influential people who had no connection whatever with the trade. They would invite some local gentleman to join. They might invite a prominent nobleman to join. In the case of the merchant tailors livery company in London, they persuaded King Edward III himself to join. After they had lent him money for his wars in France, which they knew he had the slightest intention of repaying, but they persuaded him to join. Well, that was all right with him, and it was all right with most of the noblemen. It was very nice to the trade guild. It gave them tremendous prestige. They sent it more first. As a member. Why did the noblemen want to join? Well, there were various reasons. They were beginning to realize that the growth of the city was transforming the country, and that it was very important to have to have influence in the city. They might have ideas of them standing and becoming mayor of a city, and to use their influence there. And at the very least, they got a very good dinner out of it. So they were prepared to draw it. So there was nothing new in the idea that people who were not in the building trade might become masons. Then there was another factor. In the 16th and 17th centuries, the Protestants translated the Bible into English. The Catholic Church tried their best to prevent this, to suppress it. So Thomas More, across this particular area, burning not only the English Bible, but anyone who he found reading or disseminating the English Bible. Because the Bible was elevated by the Protestants as the Word of God, the supreme authority, challenging the authority of the Catholic Church. It was all very well for the Catholic Church to say that Christ had said to St. Peter, to his petrels that are I can come there, translated. Thou art Peter, on this rock I will build my church. Of course, in the English translation, the pun is lost. So Petrus, Peter, is Petrus, the pun is lost. But it all went well for the church to say, that's what Christ said to St. Peter. So he must obey the Pope. But the Protestants say there's nothing whatever in the Bible to say that the Pope, St. Peter was a Pope. There's nothing in the Bible, as Protestant theologians, both Catholics, great black on this text. There's nothing in the Bible to say that St. Peter was ever in Rome. And they also challenged some of the most fundamental doctrines of the Church, including the feast days, including Christmas. One of them wrote a pamphlet pointing out that there was nothing whatever in the Bible that said that our Lord was born on the 25th day of December, and therefore you shouldn't celebrate Christmas. And the Bible was elevated as the Word of God challenging the Church. And so, for the Protestants, everything in the Bible must be the Word of God, must be true. This did create certain problems, as Luther himself realized, because there are contradictions in the Bible, particularly in those sections which deal with the age of the old prophets, because it doesn't quite happen. Somebody who more servants than born down just doesn't tell him the age is supposed to be. He did find ways of getting around this, explaining this. Now, in the Book of Chronicles, there is an account of the building of Solomon's temple. And it goes into the measurements. Everything says so many cubes, the square measure. Well, if the Bible is the Word of God, everything in the Bible must have a purpose. They didn't tell you all about these measurements, just the enormous defines different Bible. So people who were reading the Bible were very, very interested. Even such a clear thinking man as Sir Isaac Newton believed very strongly in it. He said that he based this theory of gravity because of what he read in the Bible of Solomon's temple. A little difficult to see how he could have thought so, but he did. And he wrote of the 470 books and wrote in yet apartments, certainly this is a sort of Bible. So this attracted people to the Masons rather than any other of these companies. And also their secrecy. Because of course in the 16th century if you were going around saying that you believed in religious toleration, it didn't really matter what religion people believed in, as long as that they just believed in God, something very nasty indeed was going to happen. Likely to be burnt to the heresy and suffer even much worse consequences than just suffered by operative Masons who formed the trade unions to get hired and wage. So the idea of secrecy spread. Now this idea of secrecy was noticed and commented on when a Freemasonry developed in the 17th century. There was also another movement that arose about this time, the Rosicrucians. A man called Andrei wrote a book published in 1615, which he described how he wandered into the depths of a wood in the Black Forest, the thickest part of the wood. He had found a little mausoleum, he'd gone in there and found the grave of Christian and Rosicrucians, who was born in 1380. And had lived to the almost unheard of age of 106 before dying in 1486, and traveled in the East and imbibed the wisdom of the East, and beside the three books Bristol Road and Oxford Britain, where most people thought this was a lot of nonsense, and that Andrei had invented the whole story and written the book himself. And I think this is more than likely, because Andrei was a Lutheran, a German Lutheran, and would give broad-minded views on religion. And these books, supposedly written by Rosenkreuz, was advocating a kind of religious violation of ideas, and particularly strongly attacked the Roman Catholic Church as the great persecutor. Well, the Rosicrucians didn't have much influence in England. I mean, they did send a few people over, but people are quite incorrectly, really, associated the Rosicrucians with the Freemasons. So in fact, there were only two individuals who were in any way prominent, who were connected with both groups. By the end of the 17th century, these ideas of religious intoleration, the scientific approach to problems, were spreading. Not everybody who believed in this approach became a Freemason. Some became Rosicrucian, some became Freemason, some didn't join any organization. But the idea was spreading that various savage religious wars were raging. It would be a very good idea if people could get together on whatever their religion, as long as they believed they were in some kind of a god. These ideas developed in England after the Revolution of 1688. The Revolution of 1688 abolished most of the persecuting laws and the religious persecution which had existed until that time. It exempted the Roman Catholics from the condemnation that had gone to everyone else. The revolution had taken place by an alliance between the Church of England and the Nonconformists, which previously been president of the Church of England, but they decided to get together, make a united front to get rid of James and there were still discriminatory nature laws against Roman Catholics. But generally speaking, there was an atmosphere of religious toleration which was possible for Freemasonry to develop. And by the beginning of the 18th century, at least 100 Masonic lodges in the country. But in 1774, in London, the four lodges were all either in the city or in Westminster, or around Covent Garden. And they got together and formed Grand Lodge. Grand Lodge met in an inn on the site of the place where the present Freemasons building is in Great Queen Street. They continued to meet in this inn until the 1770s, when they pulled the inn down and they built a large hall. In 1870, they pulled down the 1770 hall and built an even larger hall. And in 1930s, they pulled down the 1870 hall and built this present hall, which is there today, which has been on the site ever since. And they then developed under the influence of two men in particular. One was a Scottish one, the former Presbyterian, James Anderson. The more important figure was a French Protestant called his own people, who had been smuggled out of France illegally, hidden in a barrel by his parents when he was age two, because when Louis XIV repealed the Edict of Nantes in 1685, he allowed them Protestant priests to emigrate, but they weren't allowed to take their children with them. The children had to stay and be educated as Catholics in France. And if they were found trying to smuggle their children out of the country, they suffered very heavy penalties. But they did succeed in putting them to 2-year-old in a bath under the linen, and they got safely to England. But he was really the most important person behind the formation of the Grand Lodge. And he realized the country into which he had emigrated was a country no longer ruled by a national monarch, but completely dominated by the landed aristocracy. And that the way to get on in England was to get some court of aristocracy to come in. First of all, conflict, he was tutor to the Duke of Chandos' children, who lectured before George I at Hampton Court, and became the curator of the Royal Society. And he persuaded various nobles come in the Grand Lodge. After Grand Lodge was formed in 1717, for 3 years they had a commonwealth of Grand Lodge, in including in one year, is a union itself. But in 1721, a guy called the Duke of Montague would be their Grand Master. And never since, between 1721 and the year 2000, they had a common Grand Master. Their Grand Master had always been either a nobleman or, after the 18th century, a member of the royal family, the Kais. And this was enormously important. There is a letter extant from a man who, in the 1720s, was thinking of a Freemason. All his friends said the idea was ridiculous. How should he? And he couldn't even find a sufficient number of other people to form an initiative for the present of his initiation of Freemason. Then it was announced that the Duke of Montague had become the Grand Master. Immediately, everybody wanted to become Freemason. On the four lodges of 1717, it increased to over 100 lodges by 1730. It became more and more a social club. There is no doubt that the chief reason why people wanted to join was because they were so that they could sit next to a duke together. But there was also the secrecy. And this is an interesting point, because from the very earliest time, already from before the end of the 17th century, right up to the present time, the chief criticism directed at the Freemasons is the secrecy. The argument put forward by a pamphlet here in London in 1698, put forward by Tocqueville, the seventh of France, in his war against the Freemasons in 1732, put forward today by the criticism of Freemasons. If they are all clean and above board, what have they got to hide? As the Pope put it, men hide their vices, not their virtues. If there wasn't some hanky-panky going on, why the need for the secrecy? Now, after the Masons, in the 1720s, when the Masons managed to persuade all these dukes to become their Grand Master, they didn't make any secret about that. They went into a great deal of publicity. In fact, the publicity into which the Masons went in the 1720s and 1730s is worthy of any public relations officer today. They, on their feast days, this dates from the medieval times when they were still an Orthodox Catholic brother. Their patron saint was St. John, St. John the Baptist, whose feast day on the 24th of June, St. John the Evangelist, feast day on the 27th of December. And on the 24th of June and the 27th of December, the Masons went in procession through the streets of London and Westminster, all dressed up in their Masonic clothes, with the Grand Master at the head, taking very good care to notify the press that they were coming. And they were also used to attend these special gala performances put on for their benefit at Covent Garden to Drury Lane, at which some, probably a Shakespeare play would be performed, in which there would be an epilogue, saying what honour it was to her that they would perform before the noble group of Montague and these Freemasons. I mean, everything they could, right? They were really quite adamant. Every little bit of news is said in the newspapers. But on the other hand, they still kept the secrecy. And why was this? Because I think there's no doubt that the secrecy appealed to people. It was, of course, an age, the 17th century, an age where there was a lot of new development. People were learning about the world, they were studying new things. Countries, they were discovering new theories of science. And so the idea spread that there were even more fundamental secrets that God had revealed only to his Freemasons. Because the Freemasons spread us stories which were all absolute nonsense, and we still get some of them repeated today. People still today write books trying to show the connection of the Freemasons with various groups in ancient Egypt and so on, and in Babylon. And certainly the idea that this was widespread by the Masons was the power of Babel. In fact, the Freemasons said that God himself was a Mason. Even God, they said, couldn't have built heaven and earth in 6 days unless he'd been a skilled Mason. So, how they say, these ideas were spread, and this was the idea that they disseminated. Just as God had created man to be above the animals, so he had created nations to be above other men. And this was one of the great attractions that he became a nation. You learned these great secrets of the universe that nobody else knew. And to know these secrets was almost, if not quite as wonderful, as the prospect of sitting next to a human. Dead. So, so they kept their secrets. Some people thought, and indeed wrote, the only real secret that the Masons had was that they had no secret at all. This has been said at various times, and it is my own opinion that in fact is so. The philosopher John Locke, who was not a Freemason, and many of his fellow philosophers, professors, Benchmark, but he said this. He said, the secret of the Freemason is that they have no secret, but what a great secret that is. And by 1730, Freemasonry has spread. It has spread for the British colonies in North America. And it had also spread to the continent of Europe. The English emissaries from English Grand Lodge went over there, contacted English members of the board, and formed them, formed Masonic lodges. But native people, intellectuals also formed Masonic lodges. There was a great occasion when they managed to persuade the Duke of Lorraine, Francis Duke of Lorraine, Desaguliers and the others went over and initiated him to move ahead. Not long after he came to England and attended a banquet of the Freemasons, and he brought the Prince of Wales as a guest. This was wonderful. Of course, the press were no proud about this. But here they did run into a snare. Freemasonry was so closely associated with England that it aroused suspicion in Europe, in the Catholic monarchies of Europe. England was a country where the absolute monarchy had given way to a constitutional monarchy under the domination of the aristocracy, and it was also a Protestant country. Intellectuals, progressive intellectuals in Europe, looked to England and idealized England as the most wonderful place. And the English, people in England, were not so sure that it was quite such a wonderful. They knew about the corruption of the crown. They knew about the unbelievable amount of senators that were published by the Free Press, about the poverty in London, which was painted across by Hogarth and the Freemasons, and the crime and the link between the criminals and the corrupt, just as the Warbirds, which again satirized in the Beggar's Opera. They knew all about this. The people in Europe did not know about this. Most of them hadn't been to England. Those who came with disillusioned, not altogether different from all those people in this country and other countries who thought everything was so wonderful in the Soviet Union, Stalin's time, didn't think finally was quite so wonderful like that. Or even those people who did go there, these Napoleon directors, they usually said, well, with all its faults, constitutional England is still better than the absolute monarchy of Europe. But for the popes and for the king of Europe, there was something very suspicious and dangerous about a secret society which looked to Protestant and constitutional England's guidance. So it became a great suspicion. But here there's a contradiction. Many of the noblemen, particularly in France, the kings of France, insisted on being the force the Pope to recognize the nobles of Gaul coming forth. A lot of these noblemen, including some very right-wing and reactionary noblemen and members of the royal family, were interested in Freemasonry and became Freemasons. Kings didn't really object. Noblemen joined the civil lodges. They almost encouraged it and kept them out of the beginning of this ceremony. Very different when members of the middle class, when doctors, lawyers, university professors, and even more when artisans like Taylor, when they started to join the secret society, people became very suspicious. And the general picture in 18th century Europe is that the kings were much more tolerant than Freemasons, and the chief of police was. The chief of police was always coming to the king and saying, this is quite dangerous, having this secret organization. And lots of people are artisans, and this could be very dangerous. There were several occasions in France and in Austria when the police raided a Masonic lodge during a meeting. They found it a great embarrassment. Some of the people present were very high-ranking noblemen. The practice on these occasions is to let the noblemen go and ask them to depart out and then to arrest and imprison all the lower class people there. And the thing developed. And another thing which became quite clear by the 18th century, that Masonic oaths and obligations, nations speaking of oaths and obligations, come into conflict with national allegiance, with class interests particularly, or with the political ambition of the individual. A very good example of this was in France, where they, after the Pope in 1732, I should mention the point, 1736, the Pope issued a book condemning Freemasonry, elected by his successor, named chiefly using the argument of secrecy as one of the main arguments, if they're respectful of the government. And so there began a persecution of Freemasons in various countries. What happened? The Grand Duke of Tuscany was none other than Charles Duke of Lorraine, who had been initiated as a Freemason in the 1733. How he became, gave up being Duke of Lorraine and became Duke of Tuscany is a very complicated story. He was persuaded by the Emperor Charles VI to make this exchange in order to compensate the man whom the Emperor had backed, the King of Poland, who had been ousted by the Russians, which he was given on the Tuscany instead. When he took over as Duke of Tuscany, the Freemasons were clamped down upon, and several of them were arrested. The King was the secretary, who was put in prison. There was great consternation in England. Rumors went round that he'd been tortured. In fact, he wasn't tortured. He was put in the confinement of their house for petition. His Masonic brother, the Grand Duke, do anything to help him. Not a pity. That would have prejudiced his chances of becoming fully Roman Emperor, which he'd been virtually promised by So while at the same time the prosecutors and the judges were persecuting the Freemasons in France, they took very good care not to tell anybody that their Grand Duke himself was a Freemason. He took very good care not to do anything at all. The person who did try to help the Masons was the Duke of Newcastle, the British Foreign Secretary. He was not a Freemason, but he knew that politically it would be a very popular line to take up the case of people who were being persecuted for no other reason than that they were Freemasons, and I want to be more respectful than Freemasons and all these noblemen and members of the royal family being Freemasons, and yet these dreadful Catholic countries were persecuted for. So he took it up because it was a good political line. In the United States, Freemasons developed in much the same way as it was developing in England, consisting on the one hand of philosophers, speculative philosophers, and interested in ideas and religion of toleration, like Benjamin Trant in Philadelphia, but also consisting just of gentlemen who thought it was a good fashionable thing to do. Freemasons like that gentleman, George Washington of Virginia, who gave joined the Masonic Lodge because there's an interest in it. He joined just like Tucker did because it's a good social club. But when the American Revolution broke out, the Masons played a very prominent part in it. The famous Boston Tea Party, where people dressed up as Red Indians, went on to serve the ships in the harbor and threw the tea into the water because the British were importing tea, and the culture for the plan is to take the British team, a couple of red engines, jump on board the ships and crew them. And they all came out of the Freemasons' lock. Earlier spread, and we believed for many years that it was this Freemasons' lock carrying out the Boston Tea Party. Recent research has shown considerable doubt on this. It seems more likely it was organized by an association called the Sons of Liberty, who were using the Freemasons' beacon as the Freemasons' meeting. But certainly there were some Freemasons among them. And many of the leading revolutionaries, the American revolution, were Freemasons. On the other hand, many were not. Washington was Franklin were Freemasons, but Jefferson was not. Freemasons on the 4th of George the Third. And there was an interesting story about it during the American Revolution, which is attracted great publicity at the time. There was a native, what we now call Native American, used to call Indian, called Joseph Grant, the illegitimate son of an English gentleman. He was his father patronized, brought him over to England, he became a Freemason. And the American Revolution was very powerful. But Colonel John Butler, organizing a group of Mohawks under the dresses of the Indian tribes to fight with the British against the American revolutionaries. And this Joseph Grant organized and led with Americans. And the story was that one American prisoner was taken prisoner, and he was tied to a tree and was just about to be tortured to death by the Mohawks. When he made a desperate last. He made a Masonic sign. This meant the Americans in exchange. Well, this poor primitive Red Indian, he actually took his Masonic oath seriously. Not so Colonel John Butler, the leader of a band of important butlers, irregulars, who were operating within the Mohawks. This was a British officer who knew that no Masonic obligation should prevail over the duty of an officer of gentleman to service to the country. Particularly, the next time a man was taken prisoner by the Mohawks and made the Masonic sign, and this poor little Indian, Joseph Grant, he was a prisoner, Colonel John Butler was there himself. He said, "You are not a gentleman. My duty to the king comes first." That's the man to reveal where the American army was in the situation. And when he refused, he handed him over to the Mohawks, who tortured him to death, and he left his body lying down and buried under the wall. Freemasonry spread in the American army, and even George Washington was such a casual Freemason. He took it much more seriously after it became established and went along to the inauguration of the Masonic Temple. The American Revolution, including the many Freemasons among them, denounced John Butler as a war criminal. He would undoubtedly have been dead for Dr. Henry. He managed to escape to Canada. Became a head of only one example is in the people's throughout. When it comes to really the college, the such leaders who are revolutions, counter-revolution, wars, the Masonic obligations have nothing to do with it, as we compared to the political prejudices. After the American Revolution, this spread the idea that in Europe, that Masons were revolutionaries, and this was particularly so after the French Revolution. A number of Catholic writers wrote books to prove that the French Revolution had been instigated by the Freemasons. Well, there were Freemasons in the Revolution, but a lot of them were not. Fayette, who was a very moderate revolutionary, was a Freemason, Mirabeau, an equally moderate revolutionary, who was not a Freemason. Martin, an extreme revolutionary, was a Freemason, became a Freemason during his visit to the Mirabeau, extremists were not. That extreme reaction, the counter-art plot, Charles the 16th Parliament, he became Charles the Catholic, final stone after the revolution of 1830, most reactionary member of the Royal Family of France. He was a Freemason. His brother, the mayor, who was the leading right-wing theorist of the New period, who wrote in his brilliant and logical mind, showed how important it was to support his preferred religion. It was the first step in reform, so often lived with revolution. He was a Freemason, so it cut right across him. The Duke of Wellington was a Freemason. The Field Marshal, the Duke of Brunswick, who led the invasion of France in 1797, eventually Chaunay was a Freemason. Napoleon himself was not a Freemason. He encouraged Freemasonry. He said quite frankly that he was going to encourage the Freemasons because they were against the Catholic Church. He wanted to balance them against each other. He stopped the persecution of the Catholic Church, which had been carried out at the time of the Revolution, because he knew they were an important influence, and he didn't want to provoke another Catholic uprising out of taking place in the United States at the time of the French Revolution. He tried to get in and win the favor of the Catholic Church. He wanted to encourage the Freemasons to counterbalance the Catholic Church. But as he said himself, if I give toleration to Freemasons, I'll be able to make use of them. If they become too powerful, they'll make use of me. So he balanced them all against each other, very cunningly and very cleverly. But he himself was not a Freemason, but most of his brothers were. Mm-hmm. 22 of his leading field marshals were Freemasons. And under Napoleon, Freemasonry became as respectable in France as it had been in England. I identified completely with the Roman class. But after the fall of Napoleon, of course, then the old regime. Freemason in Italy was in fact an active revolution, but they were all sympathetic to the idea of the revolution, and they provided a kind of a reserve from which active new revolutionaries could draw. In fact, I think one can compare the relations of the Freemasons in Italy and the active revolutions in Italy with the relationship between Sinn Féin and the IRA. They were a group of sympathizers, though they were not. Well, by the 19th century, it had become quite clearly established. In Europe, Freemasonry was revolutionary, particularly in Italy and in Spain, and this also spread to South America, and also in Central Europe to some extent. After the revolution of 1848, Dr. Eppert, who was a lawyer in Saxony, a state prosecutor in Saxony, wrote a book about the Freemasons, in which he coined the phrase, the Freemasonry is the mother of the democracy. Of course, in 1848, democracy was a dead word. It wasn't considered a good thing. Over here in England, conservative politicians went around assuring their constituencies that they would fight to the death against any development in favor of democracy. Democracy was a very dirty word. It meant revolution and the idea that the people rather than the Philip was a king. But this was an idea that was very well established. In the United States, there was another, which was a case of William Morgan, which is probably the only real substantiated case in which a Freemason announced that he was going to leave the society and reveal the secrets of the society and was murdered as a result. It took place in upstate New York in 1826, at a time when upstate New York was really on the borders of the Wild West, and it was a very lawless place. And this William Morgan announced that he had been a Freemason, he was now going to leave it and publish their secrets. A group of local Freemasons tried to burn down Britain's publishing house. They then kidnapped him took him to Fort Niagara, which had been a fort of the federal government, but was now deserted. But the key had been given to a guard in there, a custodian, who was a Freemason. And he let the Freemasons in. And nobody quite knows what happened after that. William Morgan was certainly kidnapped by those Freemasons. The local Freemasons who did this were certainly disowned by all the leading prominent Freemasons. And apparently they took him out in a boat and contacted the Canadian Freemasons and to try to persuade the Canadian Freemasons to take charge of him and deal with him. Canadian Freemasons said, "We don't allow anything to do with it." What happens after that is indeed disputed, but there seems every reason to believe that they tied some weights to his legs and threw him out in a boat and threw him a little bit. Ollie was washed up. I was identified at the inquest as being immoral. Doubt was thrown about this. A second inquest was held. Again, they said it was William Morgan. Doubt was thrown about this. Then a lady appeared from Canada and said that her husband, she had made her husband had drowned in the river. She was shown the corpse and identified it as her husband. So it seems that no doubt that this corpse had been washed up was not the corpse of William Morgan, but was the corpse of this other man. His body was ever found. Well, the Masons said, and the Freemasons today still say, that Morgan was not murdered, that he was paid money to go away. He went away, and then the stories vary. One story is he lived among the Indians. Another is that he went to kill a pilot. If he lived for about 17 years, but I'm bound to say that these stories seem to be very far-fetched, and I think it's much more likely that after these Masons had kidnapped him, there's no doubt that they panicked and decided the best thing to do was to push. It gave rise to a very strong anti-Masonic view in the United States, very large with the refugees. Andrew Jackson, a very brilliant and charismatic president. Jackson was a man who wasn't afraid of anybody. He knew his personal popularity could defeat any movement. And in fact, the anti-Masonic movement helped him by splitting the anti-democratic vote among the Orthodox Republicans and the Freemasons. But he did cause a great rumpus and was spreading his Freemasonry in the United States and put it back for about 2 years. New development occurred at the end of the 20th century, at the end of the 19th century.
Getting on, could you actually sort of draw to? We've got lots of questions,
I'll be very brief indeed now. At the end of the 19th century, popular anti-Semitism developed in Europe, particularly in Germany, Austria, and attacking the Jews. To some extent, this took the weight off the Freemasons, because the Jews were all the Freemasons that they were in. But in countries like Spain and South America, where there were no Jews, the Freemasons continued to be the main. But even in countries where the main enemy was considered the Jews, in countries like the Balkans, also persecuted against the Freemasons. From the Freemasons became more and more sterile. I have in fact dealt with everything except the title of my talk, which I was just about coming on to. But I did warn you before I started I wouldn't be able to treat the whole list of work previously, it's possible now. But I think the best thing now would be to have questions. Don't you? Yes.
Okay, you don't want to say anything about the title, just...
Well, yes, what I was going to say again is that the present drive against Freemasonry is in this country, it's very largely directed against the establishment. Because in this country, Freemasonry is an establishment. Well, I mean, Europe and South America and so on, it's a revolution. But I think that the attack on the Freemasonry in this country is quite hysterical. A lot of the allegations are made are untrue. Certainly things, the sinister things go on in Freemasons' lodges. It's sometimes corrupt policemen and make secrets of them in Freemasons and Masonic lodges. But also there are many occasions on which corrupt policemen who are not Masons make corrupt deals with criminals in the local part, not in the local lodge. Consider that the drive against Freemasons today is a very dangerous phenomenon because it is, although it may on the surface and be represented as a criticism of the influential and the elite and the putting up the stereo. Just again, I'm not just apologizing for this skirting like this, but when we come to questions, I know what people really want to know.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. There are lots of fascinating questions there. And so we can get on to the question time. I will go through the notices extremely quickly. This afternoon, something extremely different. Sorry, something completely different. We have got.
Richard Carlisle, who was supposed to be in isn't repeating it, but telling you, actually, which an atheist, including the Muslims, the age of the East and other things, he strongly criticized Freemasonry. Here, because I think, because none of the royal family were Freemasons. On the other hand, when he was finally persecuted and prison for years, when he was finally released by the Revolution of House of Commons, his chief champion, but he was released, was Edwin Broom, who was an eminent Freemason. Well, Broom himself, having become the great radical lawyer, the champion of the Carroll, and the young man, and as Lord Chancellor introduced the new reform bill, in 1832, he ended up with the reaction. So that's what all these people do. In the House of Lords, he started to make decisions about the day. Well, that's someone else. Well, this is a tradition that dates from the time of Edward VII. Queen Victoria herself and Prince Albert were not hostile to the Freemasons. Prince Albert, I think, probably because being a German, he associated Freemasons with the revolutionary Freemasons in Europe. So they would have nothing to do with it. But Edward VII, the principal, became a very active Freemason and was Grand Master of the Freemasons. But when he became king, people said to him, well, we have to go through the formality every year or so of re-electing the Grand Master. Maybe only a formality. But just supposing how terrible it would be if people voted against the king. So the king shouldn't be a Freemason, and let's establish that he should. It had been started, actually, before it started with George I, who had been a leader of Freemasons, but he became first Prince Regent and then king. It followed again in the Andrew Jordan said that when he actually becomes king, he will be in charge of governance. Well, now this is very interesting because this is part of the story, because it all goes back to this complete mystical story of this, which was developed at the time of the building of the temple. There was a man profound, Abyss, who knew the secret of the Abyss on his temple. What it was, nobody knew, but he knew the secret. And three villains kidnapped him and told him they'd torture him and cut him up unless he told the secret. He refused, so he was murdered in this horrible way. And eventually he cut up. And then the story goes, Solomon said, I'd like to revenge to know what the secret was. Nobody knew. So he sent three Freemasons to look for the grave of Amenhotep and to try and find the secret. And if they couldn't find the secret, then the first thing that they saw when they opened the grave would be the new secret. Extraordinary story. When they opened the grave, the first thing they saw was the hand of this dead man. That is why the hand in all these various forms, gestures with the hand and shake the hand, plays such an important part in the East and West. What I think is perhaps more interesting, and I think is significant, is that these actual details of our cutting up and putting out the entrance, it's almost exactly what was done when people were hand-drawing portraits. When people were hand-drawing portraits, they were hanged, cut down or still alive, castrated, disemboweled, and then being, and their bowels burnt before their eyes, they being still living. And then only were they killed, they had their head cut off. And this is the disemboweling process of the hand-drawing portrait. Queen Elizabeth I, she didn't think it was sufficiently cruel death to have people hanged during the court. I mean, it suggests that Lord Burley, he should be able to do something more unpleasant. But he said this would be illegal, and he, as he said, provided the executioner does his job really well, he's really very nasty indeed. And during the court, he seemed most satisfied there. But I think this is no joke. in this particular disemboweling process, it is what in fact the world was like at the time. And I think that is probably the origin of it. It is interesting to note that the only authenticated case in the whole history when somebody probably, I think, was killed in the bowels of the secret was a woman murder. He was not disemboweled in this way, he was simply drowned in the Most of the stories that are told about these threats, well, some I think are completely invention, but a lot I think are sort of told semi-seriously by Masons. There have been various examples of this with people helping me in the field. For example, brother of that man, Knight, who wrote a book, a very silly book actually, trying to show that the Jack the Ripper man was simply doesn't. I mean, his facts are wrong, and the arguments simply don't stand up. I have to take it into that. When he was about 33, he was hit on the head off with his gun and came quickly and died as a result. And some people spoke the story that he had been trapped by the Freemasons. And there are examples, I think, probably true, of Freemasons who are calluses and advances. That's how they can universe, he did his job right, and these stories go on, and I think people say things more than I've seen them. Of course, it's interesting to know, officially now, the Freemasons doing all they can to do away with secrecy. If you go along to Freemasons Hall, they'll show you around and show you nearly everything. Just one or two, very few things that they keep secret, one or two secret words, the name of God, everybody knows what he's doing, what it is. It's been revealed again and again. All these secret things have been revealed.
We don't all know. Are you going to reveal it to those who don't know?
Oh, yes, it's some... representing an idea of the different gods and different religions. Well, there's been a tremendous amount of fuss made about this by the anti-Masons, the anti-Semitic Baal, of course, is actually damned in the Bible. Nobody quite knows why, but if you read the Old Testament and you read about how, they talk about people worship the golden calf and people who don't have the other, they can talk with comparatively lucidly about it. When he comes along to Baal, the millions worship Baal. The Bible is absolutely hysterical. I say that they're absolutely monstrous and unmentionable things that they did. And apparently all they really did is that they worshipped Baal rather than Jehovah, the great God. And then of course when Moses sent the children to go kill all the Midianites, they came back and said, well, we killed all of them, but then we spared the women and children. Moses said, that's frightful that you know, I killed them, can you go back and kill the women and children too? And this, I think, was the reason why they chose the 18th century and the Masons too, chose the words of Jaguar, including Baal, was as a protest against this persecutive record of Judaism and Christianity. I think it was a deliberate defense of the persecuted church of the Old Testament. But as I was saying, the Masons now, apart from this, which is a few things in particular, they say they're not secret. They've even made a video, a meeting, of a large, if anybody can see it. They say we don't have any secrets anymore. They've cut out, incidentally, some of these references to Carmen and the disembowelment of people who are serving. But this is at the top level. This is the people at the Freemasons Hall, yes. But if you go even just a little below that, you do find people on this wall of secrecy. The number of people who the Freemasons are fooling me, because in fact they allowed me to work in Freemasons for 63 days, I think I worked in their life, and they were very helpful. They know I'm not a Freemason, but they didn't make any attempt to do so. They were quite pleased with some of the reputation of the prophet Stroll, who was writing about it, because he was not a Freemason. But a number of people have said to me, but they're just pulling the wool over your eyes. Really, they've got secrets, they can say that you should know. And the interesting thing is that quite a few of the people who said that to me are Freemasons themselves. I don't think it's true, but they love to feel.
Well, that's part of it, isn't it? That's the psychology of it. Yes, you can.
Way that the Crown Prosecution Service has been working, it is very phony indeed. And but I know many cases where nothing whatever to do with Freemasons. What about the Lallans case? I don't think anybody's ever suggested that Freemasons were involved in any way in the Lallans case. Those people weren't prosecuted. Everybody knows who they are, and they're walking absolutely free. And this has happened to me repeatedly. Somebody is prosecuted. The judge tells the jury there's no evidence of it, they can convict. The jury would like to convict. He says there's no evidence. Why? Goodness knows. In some cases it may be because of the previous, but in many cases there aren't any doubt at all. There's nothing ever to do with previous.
No,
I would say
in the way that the same racism was institutionalized.
I think that you will find that there are lots of cases where some extremely friendly corrupt things go on, in which Freemasons are not involved at all. Of course, the Freemasons say, I should perhaps have mentioned, at the time of the French Revolution, there was a great panic over here. Pitt's government got very low because of the revolutionary organization that they were in. And so they passed the Unlawful Oaths Act, and the Unlawful Society Act, in 1790, which banned secret societies, including, of course, trade unions, and others, direct against the trade unions, and with this, well, this would have bound into the Freemasons. So the Freemasons went along and said, we're very, very loyal, and we've got members of the royal family. So some special provisions were introduced in that act, exempting the Freemasons from the condition of the legal oath and secret society, on condition that they registered with the justices of the That remained in force until 1967. And they did want to register the Peugeot in a few cases of the difficulty. They nearly all did. And then in 1967, the act was in the Wing of Appeal. And it was a case, I think, they came along. This was an archaic act directed against trade unions and all to repeal that whole thing. And now, of course, that they're saying that people with trade unions, the Freemasons, are saying Freemasons ought to register to disclose who they are. Freemasons said, well, we've apparently happened to do it, it's not exactly the act. But now the act is repealed, why should we be singled out? And they use the argument, it's sort of just like a golf. May help by the length of the golf club. It's not quite like the golf club, because there are various other things, including this rule which they insisted upon, that this is again something I should have mentioned, but one of the things that the English Freemasons insist on, you must believe in some kind of God. That's why they split with the French Grand Army in the 1890s. And the French Grand Army decided to admit atheists and free thinkers. And they also, the French, even from the 18th century, have admitted women. And the English Freemasons insist absolutely on excluding women. And the third factor is that the French Freemasons have quite openly, they discuss politics. And in fact, they form themselves into a real army before the Second World War to an anti-fascist organization. Whereas it's a rule of the British Freemasons, there'll be no political discussions and knowledge. I think that certainly there have been cases, not the slightest doubt, as in fact even Freemasons would have admitted, corrupt Freemasons, corrupt policemen, corrupt criminals, who are Masons helping each other. but there have also been, I think, you can find out many cases where this has been done by people who are not.
Yes, and that has strong agreement. Do you have any idea of the numbers of what's going to be connected? I'm thinking about the people.
I want to be able to tell you, but I'm afraid I can't. I had an idea about 500,000, but I may be wrong. Yes. I may be wrong. I shouldn't have mentioned it.
I've heard the estimation between 1 and 20 men, 1 and 500.
Any group
must have that percentage of
numbers.
Anyway, next
is Don Kingston. Well, may I just follow on from there? Institutions very often become what people accuse them of being. And when they, in the 18th century, when everybody went around and said, all the anti-revolutionary went around and said, Freemasons made the revolution, the Freemasons, the Freemasons lobbied on this revolution. The result was that young revolutionists joined the Freemasons because they say, if that's what revolutions are made, that's where we want to be. And in the, I'd say, about 20 or 30 years ago, people say, the rumor got around, if you want to get on, become a Freemason. Well, I know myself, my father, who was not a Freemason. I was a young man, I was just starting out as a barrister. He said to me, don't you think you'd better become a Freemason? Because that's the way you get off and the Freemasons will help you. And undoubtedly, a lot of people did join for that reason. The Freemasons say, ah, yes, that is true. And a lot of people did join for one reason. They don't do it anymore. Well, I'm not so sure. I think that some of them may still do it. But I still think it is true to say that Freemasons are more likely to give them good jobs to somebody they have met in the same class. The people are more likely to give the good jobs to somebody they have met in the local golf club. And Welshmen are very likely to give a good job to fellow Welshmen, or Scotsmen to give to a fellow Scots. So this is something that you cannot very easily get rid of. And often if I've seen it, I've been on appointment committees. And the reason that people decide to give a job to one person or another, sometimes absolutely ridiculous, sometimes absolutely improper. But it's
network, isn't it? Lots of Oxbridges, public school, it's your
mate. That is a very good point. In fact, there were two points being raised, a point that was raised earlier.
Yes.
Sorry?
Question.
Yes, I will. The question was, did the positions of the Freemasons regard to women? But if I might first answer the earlier question I didn't answer about the position of the Gartley Ireland and the lodges there. Irish Freemasonry developed just like English Freemasonry did, and it was joined by the members of the Anglo-Irish aristocracy and became very respectable indeed. But in 1798, there was a revolutionary movement developed in Ireland, and unlike so many movements in Ireland, it was completely non-sectarian. Both Catholics and Protestants wanted to make a revolution and looked to the French Revolution and were expecting the French to come and liberate them. And they unfortunately for them, Napoleon decided he didn't care two hoots about liberating the Irish, he wanted to go and conquer Egypt instead. But at that time, Freemason lodges were infiltrated in Ireland by revolutionists, just as they were in Europe. And the Secretary of State for Ireland, who was Thomas Pelham, the son of the Earl of Chichester, he wrote to Lord Dunmore, who was the Earl of Dunmore, who was the Grand Master of Ireland, and saying, not being myself a Freemason, I am not as well placed as you are Welsh, to ensure that members of the lower orders of society do not use Masonic lodges in order to further their sedition and leveling doctrines. This was indeed the attitude. The establishment in Ireland is solidly anti-revolutionary, but the lower middle class people did come in Ireland as they done elsewhere and use it for revolutionary purposes. Now this very interesting question about women. It's very interesting to know that as early as the 1720s, people were criticizing the Freemasons for not admitting women. And this is rather significant because, of course, in the 1720s, nobody expected the women to be members of parliament or to sit on juries or to be doctors or lawyers or to go to the university or do anything. But they were very much the centre, particularly the aristocratic circles. They were the centre of social life. And the fact that people commented on the fact that the Freemasons didn't have women in shows, I think, how much in England in the 1720s Freemasons were considered as a purely social organization, and the Freemasons largely were considered as a good in social clubs. And then people said the Freemasons were very key to dispel this, and said, oh no, we like women. One of them were songs, one of their drinking songs. No one can the ladies adore Freemason. And at one of the performances that was put on, when they put on these special performances of the jury lay for the Freemasons, and they had these actresses who were reading special epilogues for it. But one of them, on occasion, was the actress, this is Herman. Anyway, this was the performance of Henry the First Part Two in Drury Lane in 1728. The actress, Mrs. Foreman, came on and spoke a special epilogue to the occasion, and which she was a woman. Ye married ladies, 'tis a happy life, believe me, that was a Freemason's life. Though they conceal the secrets of their friends, in love and truth they make us full amends. The arguments that the Freemasons gave and still give, because they still exclude women here, and they still say they won't have anything to do with the French Freemasons, or with any of the foreign Masons who do not exclude women. That's a cardinal principle. And the reason they give several reasons. First of all, they say historically, in the Middle Ages, women didn't climb up and do work on cathedrals. The Archie of Masons were always men. But that's a couple of fathers, fathers. Then they say, but if women came in, the men would be distracted, so they would concentrate on their duties by the charms of the women. And people would then say that it was a lie, that they were asked what was going on if women came in the lodge. A more plausible argument, I think, is that women aren't really all that keen to become Freemasons. Some are. There are a few special Freemason lodges, I'm not recognized by the Grand Lodge. But on the whole, my experience, the same with the City Livery Company, which I belong to, on the whole, when they're quite happy that their husband should go off occasionally to some of these lodges, they don't mind all that much. Those who are very keen, they should come in. But I do think that their attitude to women is extraordinary, impassioned and stupid, and I don't think it can be possibly maintained for another 20 or 30 years. I think you'll have to admit women if they want to go on. Otherwise, no one would take them seriously. Perhaps, in a way, it's a defense mechanism, and people try and suggest that the Freemasons are very dangerous and powerful organization. With the role that women are now playing would be even more in 20 or 30 years. No one would believe that an organization that excludes women could possibly exercise any influence at all in this country. I think it's not all bad. They are far more solid in France.
It sounds like the Catholic Church and Anglican Church, though, they've put the reasons for keeping women out of the priesthood or doing anything important in the church. It's really only psychological reasons rather than any sensible reason. It's your name.
I wonder whether one tradition.
Now, this is very interesting. The person, the. Well, first of all, I'm going to keep the deal with you. The theory is, the myth is, that it was introduced by Peter the Great when he came over to England and working in Cornwall as a shipwright in the 1690s. He joined England, the Sonic Lodge. And the Russian Freemasons spread this story because obviously Peter the Great introduced it, they had not been respected, and they are likely to be true. But throughout Russian history, you have the same picture we had in other countries, particularly after Russia. These benevolent guests, like Catherine the Great, and the Tsar, Alexander the First, all these people, first of all, they encouraged Freemasonry. Yes, we read Voltaire, it's wonderful, let them all go and discuss it. Then the chief police comes to them and says, you know, it is frightful dangerous having this super organization. You don't know what they may be used for. And before long, these benevolent sufferers, including Alexander the First, who probably was himself a Freemason, he ends up by issuing a decree suppressing Freemasons. And this was done in Mr. Nicholas the First and all these tribes did. There seems no doubt that the people who conducted the first, the Russian Revolution, possibly Kerensky himself, was his doctor, were the Freemasons. The Bolsheviks came along and in 1922 they banned Freemasonry. They wrote, in fact, Trotsky wrote a thing saying, Freemasonry is a petty bourgeois movement which in its time and in certain places have been a revolutionary force, but are now a counter-revolutionary force that is only simply going to communist party about whatever they can do. But some French communists, including Marquis and Cushing, were Freemasons. And when Henri Marquis, of course, built the mutiny of the French fleet in 1920, when the French fleet was sent to intervene against the Bolsheviks during the Russian Civil War. Henri Marquis organized a mutiny. He was arrested and sent to a long-term prison for all over the region. He then tried to get the Freemasons to back him. He said, I'm a Freemason. He went to the Freemasons in a very large room by the radical party. And they said, you should back me. And of course, they said, oh, once you see a communist, you need another time. But the attitude of the communist has led. We know how the communists have changed their life. When the communists have been pursuing a policy of a popular front and an anti-fascist, then they've been quite friendly for the Freemasons. When they revert and produce hard lines, then they tend to count down the Freemasons. But when they, in 1935, the popular front is being formed, and then they were the socialists, the Tarrés and the communists, came in and wanted to make the popular front radicals. People said to them, well, the Freemasons have so much influence in the radical party, we never get the radical party to come in unless you get the Freemasons on our side. Boris Tarrés went along to the Freemasons Lodge and made a speech and said how much the communists love the Freemasons and how we can all work together. And certainly during the war in France, but there again was a conflict because the leadership of the Freemasons was the Grand Master. He did a direct like he sort of grabbed the whole pattern, wrote the pattern from home without the pattern. And then when the girl came back, he was at the door, the whole locked the door. But then the other Masons did fairly profit from the French. It's just for the 50,000 Masons in France, I think 6,000 were actually who just mastered it. This is the picture you see. On the one hand, the radical Freemasons, on the other hand, the reaction.
I think that is so, and men do like joining men's clubs.
Yes.
And don't get lost, it's varied at certain times. In the 19th century, the club formed, the idea at the beginning of the century, you had a men's club and all men together. At that time, if lots of men got together, people didn't assume that they were homosexual, because of course they would not. But at that time, if you sit up there, I also met this part of the barrister, because the barrister's men, the barrister's messes tend to exclude women. probability that the city didn't mind it. I think one very important factor is that the men must be able to tell dirty jokes, and they are embarrassed. They are embarrassed at telling dirty jokes in front of women. Perhaps they aren't anymore now, I don't know. But in my they don't quite happen now. But in my generation, they felt mostly they shouldn't tell a dirty joke in front of women. And they want to tell dirty jokes in the mess, in the office of the mess, and embarrassed. I think that's got something to do with it. Yes, but certainly.
That is so.
Yes, so that is so. But they do like keep them.
It's interesting about that
hair
suggestion. Yeah. Because if you take the Nazis and
but I must say that when I read somebody writes and says that is a typical example of how among the ruling class they exclude women and they exclude blacks and so on, I do wonder just how many of the people who've always voted Labour all their lives, the working class Labour group, how many of them are always keen to have women in their men's class and have blacks and packets in?
Yes, and the formula is a cup of cold with nowhere in particular as regards getting away from women.
Well, there were four people in the queue. We're going to have to finish it. There were four people in the queue and now I've got two more. So we'll have the six people, but you must all be very brief. Now, you two have been waiting. So we'll have you and then Peter and then David. And then Barbara, then Prevailing, then Norman. Right, we're going to stick to that. So, right, so you start.
Yeah, I was wondering about today, currently,
over the racial thing is interesting because when they started off in India, for example, when they were there, they did not allow native people there. And then, already by the beginning of the 19th century, the Duke of Sussex was very keen that Native Indians should be allowed in. In fact, they found it almost impossible to get in. There's one particular case, I can't remember the man's name, who was excluded again and again from the clubs in India. He eventually went to France and was admitted there and a Freemason. Well, they've now, of course, tried to counter this a lot. Yes, they welcomed him in. It's the same in the United States. For a long time, the blacks were excluded. Now they have to welcome him in, or at least to say that they don't. In some countries, of course, the racial issue comes in very important. In the fundamental, in the Muslim fundamental countries, cremations are still persecuted. They really are. I mean, in Iran, I think it's a death sentence for cremation. And the Taliban in Afghanistan. Japan, there was a grave response. I think it is very large. They're 18 drinking cups still. They certainly have excellent attendance. But they do also have discussed what they can do for charity. You better get the video that they make. See the video that they make. But of course, the video that they give you, you may well say, doesn't cover all the things they really do. But I think that's what they're able to see. I don't really know, actually.
Their meetings are secret, aren't they? I mean, their meetings are secret. One can't go along as a spectator.
No, you can't join unless you belong. I mean, you must be a member of. You must have joined. But as I say, they've now made a video.
Public relations.
Yes, indeed, yes. Yeah.
Invite them
into
the
public relations
to learn about
the initiation, of course, that's another matter, that too is something about. But apart from that, I think partly in the initiation sense, I think it realizes a social
thing. I can vouch for the children's parties. When I was a child, the next door neighbour was a mason, took me and my brother and sister to the annual children's party, and it was the most incredible party. And the food was very good, the games were good, the prizes were good, it really was something to look forward to. I used to look and see if I could see anything secret, but I never did. Anyway, it's now, oh, it's David. Good to be here.